Tonight, I'm going to be talking about liberation, which is sort of the postscript to the Eightfold Path. I'm not going to be talking so much about what liberation is, but how to get there, because the how explains the what. How to get there begins with the Eightfold Path. So to those of you who have just completed the course that ran from last November until the end of next week, congratulations. I should give you all little certificates of completion. But you've earned something far more valuable. You have familiarized yourselves with the concepts and the practices that the Buddha wanted to impart to you. Now they are yours, and you know how to use them. You may not feel proficient in all of them. That doesn't matter. If you've gone through it once or more, you know it's there. You know that tool is in the box. Now, for everyone, that course still exists on the Alameda Sangha website. And it's on the page titled 2018 to 19 Eightfold Path Course. It's also accessible through rebeccadixon.org. And there are links between the two sites. The course is designed for a month of practice on each of the parts of the Eightfold Path, with suggested practices every week. And it's all there, and everything but my sending the email out to you to remind you. The path is not intended to be just intellectually understood, but to be lived. And to live it, we need to learn how through practicing with it. If you have any questions about any part of the course that's online now, you can use the contact function on my site or my email address if you still have it. That course is laid out the way the Buddha gave it to us, from wise understanding to wise concentration, with ethics kind of in the middle. So it will make the most sense to work with it in that order. But of course, you can spend a month or more on any particular part that's particularly juicy for you. But remember that there is a big payoff for having a close relationship with the path in its entirety. And that payoff is liberation. The path has a beginning and an end. It starts with our not knowing how to free ourselves from the inner suffering called dukkha. And it ends with that freedom being achieved. The suttas call our not knowing ignorance, often translated as delusion, as in greed, hatred, and delusion, being the core causes of dukkha. But there are a lot of icons and paintings that show the snake or the rooster, whatever animals, craving and aversion arising out of the ignorance. So it is the core of the cores. Ignorance plays a really massive part and a wicked role in our overall well-being or lack thereof. Ignorance in this sense, isn't merely the absence of a fact, but a kind of mental blindness that casts a veil of distortion over all of our experience. We start life with a wide open field of awareness, and it's steadily compromised. It fascinates me to watch babies regarding their world. They're totally absorbed in the touch, taste, and appearance of things. And what happens when they do this or that? And they'll do it over and over to see if there's consistency there. Among the first things that babies learn are their relationships and their names. Who meets their needs, holds them in comfort and love? The idea of me starts to grow soon after they associate with the name, and they know what they want, and they want it now. And that is so compelling that their awareness, for the time being, will narrow down to that. And anger and dissatisfaction assert themselves for that baby in tears and crying. The root of ignorance has been planted. That open field of awareness that we begin with starts to shrink and warp. That baby, like the rest of us, has acquired the basic belief that they are a self. And as Bhikkhu Bodhi puts it, we assume we have an innate right to pleasure and direct our efforts to increasing and intensifying our enjoyment, I love this phrase, with an anticipatory fervor, undaunted by repeated encounters with pain, disappointment, and frustration. And there usually follows after that decades of mental and physical habits that further ingrain ignorance and the suffering it causes into our minds. And we wonder why we can't get this more quickly. It's a lot of habit. By the time we encounter the idea that we suffer like everyone else because of a very basic way we think, ignorance has so thoroughly infiltrated our minds that the Buddha's first two noble truths may be incredibly hard to accept. A lot of people will look you in the eye and tell you they don't suffer. But some people do accept the truth of suffering and that it's caused by clinging. We just get tired of all that unhappiness. And then we learn the rest of the Four Noble Truths, that the clinging which causes dukkha can be ended. And the way to do that is the Eightfold Path. And here we are. We still suffer, though, don't we? Even after 8 months with the Eightfold Path. So I implore all of you, whether you took the course or not, to look back. Do you have a better idea of why you tend to be unhappy in certain ways than you had before you started your practice? Have some of the habits that caused your dukkha fallen away? Are there more moments of peace and contentment in your life? Please recognize, acknowledge, and celebrate these changes. This progress that's happened. And please look for how your practice helped it come about. Why is it that I so often emphasize this looking back and comparing our lives then and now? Because each bit of improvement in our well-being is liberation. Liberation from dukkha. And by giving the credit due to your practice, you encourage it to grow and earn more freedom for you. After we've practiced with the whole Eightfold Path and lived it for a while, we begin to get it in a new way. We continue practicing with the path as the circumstances of our lives demand. And by that I mean that our very suffering will begin to guide us to open this chest of remedies that we've acquired and pick out the intention or action or meditation practice that is wise in meeting this challenge to our well-being and to the well-being of others. And as we use these remedies or tools, insights that help end our dukkha will arise. Often they arise at odd moments when maybe we're just walking down the street or at a time that seems unrelated to our practice. Sometimes I get insights during my meditation and I can clearly see what brought them into being. But a lot of the time, I have to intentionally look to see how my practice contributed to this untangling of my mind. We start out walking on the Eightfold Path as we would walk along any path, sometimes with a natural ease, or when the going gets rough, with due care and attention. As we go along in our lives on the path, we keep uprooting this or that cause of dukkha, and our liberation grows. There are specific practices beyond the Eightfold Path. Different teachings take different approaches to saying just what those practices are. But from where the graduates of our Eightfold Path course are now, the path leads toward liberation with a capital L. That can feel daunting to some people, like, oh no, I don't need that in my life, or I can't do that. But you know, you don't really need to think about it yet. I'm just telling you. Just keep walking along the path, using what you've learned about it. The two main things to stay conscious of as you go are suffering and the role of the self in it. You don't need anything additional to go forward from here. Life will provide you with plenty of practice. One way of looking at the path beyond the path is called the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the title of Bhikkhu Bodhi's book. It's something a little different than what's sometimes called the mundane Eightfold Path. Tanisro Bhikkhu says in his book, The Wings to Awakening, that what ennobles our path from the mundane to the noble is intensive practice with its first part, which is wise understanding, often called right view. It is a practice of intensively studying our suffering, how the self and ignorance assert themselves in craving and aversion, and in that way cause our suffering. And we also study how to end it. We can examine this core assumption in our lives, which is that we have these lives, using some very basic questions while we're both meditating and going through the day. We just ponder, are we our bodies? Are we our thoughts or emotions, moods or attitudes? Are we our experiences, our memories? Are we ourselves as babies or young adults or senior citizens? If I had a massive stroke and lost most of my mental abilities, would I still be me? Which abilities would I have to regain to be fully me again? And what does that even mean? And how much of what we believe is projection about what others might think of us? Relationships are probably the richest area to study dukkha. And that suffering is always tied right to our notion of ourselves. Me plus you equals us. And what does that mean? Can we identify where in that equation is our clinging, our suffering? Whenever we assume something or anything about others, ignorance casts a long shadow. So it's not a surprise that we suffer a lot in our closest relationships. It's hard to function without imagining other people's thoughts and feelings, or so we believe. But is it true? Don't ask me for that answer. The richness of the exploration that I'm suggesting is in the questions that we dare to ask and how we can live fully without what we normally would consider answers. Can we live in the not knowing? In addition to personal relationships, there is also what can be called our place or places in society. We always tend to want to improve these places, often without very clear ideas of what they are. This whole realm of dukkha is closely tied to our expectations of society and ourselves. Desires that harden into expectations are like muscle cramps. They're painful and disabling. Not getting the rewards or recognitions that we feel we deserve can be an ocean of suffering with a fresh wave of dukkha every day. It can be their fault or ours or both. Or maybe there's an entirely different way to think about the situation. If, as a result of our practice, we have insights into the way we might be contributing to our social discomfort, we might courageously confront the source of our expectations about ourselves. We need to be careful, though, not to just try to become some notion of ourselves other than the one we already have. Both of those notions are just ideals, and maybe not even very good ones, and they're not likely to be fully realized because they keep getting edited as we go. Complicating all of this is the issue of identity, which is a social construct foisted upon us by society, whatever that is, and as harmful to all members of the society as the idea of self is to us as individuals. Self and identity, very closely related and mischievous, can cause us some real trouble. Sometimes we get so weighed down and hobbled by our cravings to be other than exactly what we are now. It's enough to make the heart overflow with compassion. Many people feel that it's their duty and right to change society. This is a wholesome effort, one that I've made for most of my life. But it can be a chaotic one, like tilting at windmills sometimes. Especially when it's closely tied to a sense of self-worth. It can lead to discouragement, bitterness, and many other unhelpful states of mind. Now, since November, I've had the honor of listening to many people grapple with their mind's habits and how they cause suffering in themselves and in their relations with others. We all have mental formulations that we've never questioned, where ignorance has free rein. So many of us live with defense mechanisms that were fashioned by young children. These defenses don't really work for grown-ups, and they cause trouble, and then we apply the same unsuitable tools to deal with that trouble, and it just keeps snowballing. Studying the Eightfold Path and practicing with each part of it means we can grasp new tools to fix these problems. Many students want to be told which tool to use. During that course, I would suggest trying the one we were working on that month. But sometimes that one didn't tackle the problem. The path beyond the path requires a curiosity about all of the tools in that eightfold box and the patience to keep trying another tool or combining some of them in a new way. We need to be willing to examine the views that we hold and catch the assumptions that prompt certain thoughts or urges. We may need heroic levels of patience to change deeply ingrained habits, especially if they're rooted in painful ancient experiences. Sometimes seeing a therapist can help. But always keep looking back at your progress so far to get the faith and determination to keep chipping away at monolithic patterns of mind and conduct. Take breaks if you need to. Don't become obsessed or compulsive, but don't give up. When we intentionally live with the whole path in all our experience, we're on the Noble Eightfold Path. Gil Fronsdale often calls what's after the mundane path the Tenfold Path. It adds the two new parts of knowledge and release to the first eight. Gil says, right knowledge is knowing firsthand the benefits experienced through living the path and the suffering experienced when we don't live the path. We should always be alert to these benefits, which can include greater peace, integrity, freedom, and well-being. When we have gained these benefits by freeing ourselves from dukkha, and then understand how this was done, that's the ninth part of the path, the wise knowledge. Recognizing the benefits and what led to them. The more our practice alleviates suffering, the more deeply we understand the cause and effect of dukkha, and the more we are liberated. It isn't uncommon to have residual fear of letting go of the causes of suffering, especially where it concerns what Gil calls our most precious and tenacious attachment to self. He assures us, freedom from clinging doesn't diminish us. On the contrary, it breaks down the walls that have kept us squeezed into a small, cramped concept and lets us expand into the fullest engagement with all our experience. Some students asked me over the years what it is we're supposed to let go into. Gil says, letting go of clinging is letting go into peace. Right release is what can seem like a mystical notion of liberation, but it's real. It can consist of dropping this and that harmful habit, all adding up to greater and greater freedom. Or it can be nibbana, a permanent release of what causes all suffering. This Pali word means burning out of the root cause of clinging, ignorance itself. The suttas and the millennia of commentary in the different traditions of Buddhism lay out a variety of steps leading to this ultimate liberation. And they're fascinating to scholars and advanced practitioners. But who knows what steps you're going to be taking? My approach is to keep looking at the causes of clinging, craving, aversion, and ignorance, and appreciating all progress so far. For me, craving has diminished a lot, aversion somewhat less. But I am so grateful for every link that has dropped from the chains of my dukkha. May you continue with determination and ever-growing peace on the whole Eightfold Path and beyond. Thank you.